Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Momentarily, we'll get the latest on COVID-19 on this final day of our fall member drive. But first, we have some major news to report. The U.S. Supreme Court is not immediately blocking the Texas law that bans most abortions, but the court just announced it will hear arguments in the case in early November. The justices saying within the past hour, they'll decide whether the federal government has the right to sue over Texas's law. The court's action leaves in place for the time being a law that clinics say has led to an 80% reduction in abortions in the nation's second largest state. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote that she would have blocked the law now. The justice said the promise of future adjudication offers cold comfort, however, for Texas women seeking abortion care who are entitled to relief now. The law has been in effect since September. Aside from a district court-ordered pause that lasted just 48 hours, the Texas law bans abortions once cardiac activity is detected, usually around 6 weeks and before some women know they are pregnant. Again, the U.S. Supreme Court is not immediately blocking the Texas law, but has agreed to hear arguments on the federal government standing to sue over the law. That'll be heard in early November. We also just received word that the actor Peter Scolari, who rose to fame alongside Tom Hanks in the sitcom Bosom Buddies and then later appeared with Bob Newhart in the TV series Newhart, has died after a 2-year battle with cancer. Peter Scolari was 66. He was also known for his prolific work on stage, and he also won an Emmy for his work on the HBO series Girls. And then, of course, we have the very latest on the tragedy that unfolded in Santa Fe, New Mexico, a movie set there, a Western starring and co-produced by Alec Baldwin. The actor fired a prop gun on the set of the Western that he was making. It killed the cinematographer. The director of the movie was wounded, and authorities have launched an investigation of what's happened. Galena Hutchins, the cinematographer on the movie Rust, and director Joel Souza were shot yesterday in the desert just south of Santa Fe. A spokesman for Baldwin said there was an accident involving the misfire of a prop gun with blanks. Santa Fe County Sheriff spokesman Juan Rios said detectives are investigating what type of projectile was discharged and how. No immediate charges were filed. And in a Twitter release by Alec Baldwin, he said, "There are no words to convey my shock and sadness regarding the tragic accident that took the life of Galena Hutchins, a wife, mother, and deeply admired colleague of ours. I'm fully cooperating with the police investigation. My heart is broken for her husband, their son, and all who knew and loved Galena." That's the statement on Twitter from Alec Baldwin. And we'll continue to keep you updated on this tragic story throughout the course of the day here on Air Talk. We now turn our attention to the latest on COVID-19, and joining us to talk about the very latest, Dr. Sam Torbati from Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Thank you, sir, for joining us again. We appreciate it very much.
Good morning, and thank you for having me, Larry.
Let's begin first with yesterday's CDC recommendation that those who received Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines in many cases get boosters. Walk us through who should now make their appointments or walk in to get their shots.
Well, we have one last step because we need one last approval, which we anticipate happening today. So I suspect later today, you'll probably announce the information as it gets finalized by the director of the CDC. And basically, once this goes through, then the same guidelines for the that went through for the Pfizer booster will apply for individuals who've had the Moderna vaccines. And there will also be availability for individuals who have received the Johnson & Johnson to get boosters from Johnson & Johnson. And we also anticipate for there to be an allowance for crossing over of vaccines. There's actually information that's come forward that suggests that if somebody started with the Johnson & Johnson, if they get one of the mRNA vaccines as a booster, they actually have better immunity. So this will get finalized, and I anticipate that as early as, I guess, maybe tomorrow, but more likely by Monday, pharmacies and institutions will be ready to roll.
We're talking with Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, a co-chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine, Dr. Sam Torbati. We're taking your calls and your questions on COVID-19 and vaccines at atcomments@kpcc.org. Please email us your location and first name along with your question, or you can call 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. I thought I saw that the director of the CDC had actually come out and endorsed what their advisory panel has said. So we're just going to confirm that, because I think at this point that the pharmacies are actually free to start offering those booster doses as well as other locations. We're just going to check on that to see if she actually did issue that formal order. Perhaps she just mentioned it, but has not released it in writing to this point. 866-893-5722. Pfizer said that its vaccine is nearly 91% effective against symptomatic COVID-19 for children ages 5 to 11. Dr. Torbati, very high rate of effectiveness for kids.
Oh, absolutely. And this is wonderful to see this kind of data brought forward by Pfizer. They studied several thousand children between 5 and 11. And it's this kind of data that's going to be used by the FDA and the CDC as they look forward to providing initial EUA authorization for the vaccine for the younger children. I anticipate this will probably take until November, until the all the different committees that look at this data and validate it actually make it happen and allow it to happen. So probably November timeline, about a month away.
All right, 866-893-KPECC. You can also tweet at AirTalk. Please include your location, or you can post on the AirTalk Facebook page as well. President Biden had promised back in August that boosters would be offered to all adults. But at this point, of course, it's more select. The exception being with the J&J, that the booster there is recommended for anyone 18 and over who received the J&J more than 2 months ago, which is going to be virtually everybody at this point. And again, the recommendation that you can cross over to an mRNA vaccine if you prefer, either Pfizer or Moderna, or you could get a second dose of J&J. And Dr. Torbati, do you have a recommendation as to whether for someone who's taken a shot of J&J, they should switch to an mRNA? Would that give them more protection than if they got another J&J?
Yes, the data currently suggests that certainly getting a second J&J is very appropriate, and it'll add to the immune response and provide additional protection. But that potentially crossing over to a mRNA product can provide potentially even higher immunity. And so for individuals who don't have any, you know, known concerns over the mRNA, and really the mRNA vaccines are incredibly safe, that that may be a very good tactic. And when you look at the data, you know, of the 190 million Americans that are fully vaccinated, only 15 million have had the J&J. So crossing them over to the mRNA as boosters is not a bad idea at all.
866-893-KPECC. Paul in Long Beach says, I understand if you've had J&J, then your follow-up can be or should be an mRNA vaccine. I don't think it's should is the recommendation, Paul, as we just heard from Dr. Torbati, but you certainly can. If you've had the Moderna vaccine, Paul wants to know, should you wait for the Moderna booster or get another? The Moderna booster, by the way, should be available perhaps even later today to get that. We'll hear what Dr. Torbati has to say about whether you'd go for another Moderna or go for another. I myself have had two Moderna shots, and I'm going to take the Moderna booster. That's my intention. I'm just going to stay with the same thing that I got because I was able to tolerate it. It's Air Talk on KPECC.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us with Cedars-Sinai Medical Center co-chair, the Department of Emergency Medicine, Dr. Sam Torbati. We've talked to this point about the CDC's recommendations for who should get boosters, who previously received Moderna and J&J vaccines. Of course, the advice has already been out there for specific segments of the population for Pfizer booster vaccination. And we've seen Pfizer's data indicating a nearly 91% efficacy rate against symptomatic COVID-19 in their trial for children ages 5 to 11. If you have questions for Dr. Torbati, now is the chance to ask at 866-893-KPECC or email us, including your location and first name, at atcomments@kpecc.org. Dr. Torbati, scientists in San Diego and throughout the United States are working under grant-funded research to come up with what would be a pan-coronavirus vaccine that would apply to more than just a specific type of coronavirus. What are the prospects for getting something that would protect against multiple forms? You know, given that the specific spike proteins can, produce their own particular problems.
Yes, this is very, very promising. As you and your very complex audience knows, there's three different types of coronaviruses, and the first type of coronavirus just caused and continues to cause minor colds and flus. There was the SARS-1, which was a much more concerning virus, and now the SARS-2, which is the cause of COVID-19. They're all coronaviruses, and so they share a lot of the same family of characteristics. And the thinking and planning around this new science is that if we can identify proteins on all three that don't mutate, that they all also have in common, that we could target vaccines to basically go after that. And if we could do that, then we basically can even have better tools in our armamentarium to eradicate coronaviruses altogether. And there's very good thinking that could actually be a possibility. We'll find out in the upcoming months and years as to whether the science can develop to make that happen.
Ruth in Manhattan Beach says, my husband and I went to our local CVS and got Moderna boosters. The worker had to record the shots in the computer as a first dose, but gave it to us. There were a lot of people waiting as well. Ruth, I'd be curious, though, if you got a third dose of Moderna, that's the full-on third dose, same as you got the first two shots, or if it was actually a Moderna booster of the half dose. That's what's not clear at this point, is what are pharmacies actually giving out. We had another listener, Kelly in Marina Del Rey, who said he got an appointment at his local CVS and was going to be getting a Moderna booster later today, but they called him back and canceled the appointment because they said that the slots weren't actually available yet. So you see that the pharmacies are still sort of getting up and running on this, even though the CDC has made its recommendation for Moderna and for J&J boosters. Sophia in Silver Lake asks, for those who are going to be getting a Moderna booster, does it make sense to go for the half dose that was tested and approved for a Moderna booster, or go for a full Moderna? Is there any loss of efficacy in the half dose?
That's a great question. And I would suggest really for everybody to go with what has been tested and trialed. Again, anytime we introduce new vaccines or medications to the human body, we always want to monitor for side effects. And so the data from Moderna that was brought forward for review by the FDA and CDC was the half dose. Keep in mind also that Moderna in general is a much higher dose to begin with. Moderna's standard dose is 100 micrograms. Pfizer's is 30. So if for individuals who received a half dose of Moderna, they're getting 50 micrograms, which is still higher than a full dose of Pfizer. So I would follow the guidelines. Again, we're just cautious, and we'd hate to have side effects that are unexpected for therapies that weren't tested. The likelihood is very low. And if you received a full dose, I wouldn't worry.
Yeah.
But I would follow the guidelines.
We all know people, I think, who've gotten third full doses of Moderna and, had symptoms similar to what they had with the second one. Nothing, more severe. But again, that's not a clinical trial. That doesn't give us a side-by-side comparison. And I have to say, I think it would have been helpful if Moderna had released information on the antibody response from the half dose as a third shot versus the antibody response of a full dose in the third shot, because then people could make up their minds for themselves how much they were willing to risk a larger side effect from a full dose third shot, and weigh any possible advantage in 100 versus 50 versus side effects. And unfortunately, we're not given that opportunity to make that decision with full knowledge.
No, and it's tough because the science is evolving so incredibly fast. And really, I must say, there's more transparency around this science than anything I've seen in my 25 years in medicine. Things are moving very fast. The companies are trying to get as much data as quickly as they can, trying to get it to the FDA and CDC. And again, in terms of major, side effects for the mRNA vaccines, it's the very rare side effect around things like pericarditis. And, if a smaller dose of any therapy is just as good as a larger dose, then the smaller dose is probably better.
All right, 866-893-KPCC. Virginia in Torrance says, my family from Guatemala came here and got the J&J vaccine. They'd like to have the second dose, but they're healthy and in their 40s and 50s. Are they able to get it? Virginia, it's my understanding that for people who received a dose of J&J, everybody 18 years of age and over is eligible for a booster if it's been at least 2 months. Is Is that correct, Dr. Torbati?
Yes, absolutely. And they should go to a local pharmacy. And as Larry, you mentioned, all the pharmacies are ramping up to have their products ready to go. And I would advise for your family member to go get an mRNA product.
All right. 866-893-KPECC. Let's see. We have a question from Kathy in South Pasadena, who emailed us, I'm in the Novavax trial. Would you recommend moving to another vaccine, and which one? I'm curious, Kathy, if they've given you any sort of guidance in the clinical trial that you're in, because I would expect that participants in the trial would be given some sort of guidance. Kathy, great question. Dr. Torbati?
I agree with you, Larry. I think once you're in a clinical trial, you're sort of being monitored for a lot of different things. And there's just no data. We just don't know as to, you know, whether moving over is a good idea or not. So I would speak to the trial conductors and express your concerns and get some feedback from them.
All right. Yeah, because you'd hate to in any way, skew the trial by something that you did. Maria in Garden Grove said, I received a Moderna booster at my local Rite Aid. I've had no pain, no fever, no side effects. Does that mean it didn't work? Well, Maria, it depends, too. If there can also often be many hours later that people have their effect. That was certainly my case with my second Moderna. There was a delay before I started feeling the effects of that. But my understanding, Dr. Torbati, is just because you don't have any side effects from getting it does not mean that your immune system was not activated.
That you're absolutely correct. The absence of side effects does not mean that there's anything wrong with your immune system. It just means that you're actually lucky. The data on the antibody response and everything is equivalent. So she should consider herself lucky. It's good.
Yeah. And again, if you just got it today, just be cautious and understand you could be getting a result from it tomorrow. But I think one of the reasons with the boosters that Moderna advocated the half dose is because there would be fewer side effects, correct? Wasn't Dr. Torbati that the reasoning behind it?
That was one of the thinking behind it. And the other thinking, I believe, was that the two previous doses actually had a little bit of a superior longer term protection. And so I think when they did the risk analysis, they felt that providing a third dose that is a smaller dose would get them to the sweet spot where we have extra protection, but we minimize side effects.
All right. Dr. Sam Torbati, Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, where he co-chairs the Department of Emergency Medicine. Dr. Torbati, wonderful to have you with us on this day, a rather momentous one when it comes to CDC guidance for vaccination. Thank you, sir, and have a terrific weekend. And please share with all of your colleagues at Cedars-Sinai our appreciation for the great work you're doing.
Appreciate you and your audience. Thanks so much, Larry.
Dr. Sam Torbati, Cedars-Sinai, joining us every day on Air Talk, the very latest on COVID-19.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Oh.
Our producer, Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, was just telling me what the technology is bringing the guests to us in the next segment. And it's funny because we have so many ways now, and this really came about during the pandemic, to get better sound quality putting guests on our air than just simply using a cell phone. And I think of all this technology, it's paid for by listeners. All this stuff is networked into our audio console so that we can bring all this to you. And I'm so glad that we have it. Sometimes it poses its own challenges, as sometimes newer technology does. But I'm just so glad we have it. And it's because of listeners like you. So thank you very much. It's time for the Triple Play as we celebrate last night's blowout 11-2 Dodger win over the Atlanta Braves, keeping the team alive. The Dodgers win yet another elimination game, and the series lives to go back to Atlanta for Game 6 tomorrow. The start time is undetermined. It's pending what happens in tonight, American League Game 6. And then should the Dodgers win on Saturday, then Sunday would be the determining Game 7 starting at 4:30. Joining me for the Triple Play today, of course, is Nick Roman, our host of All Things Considered, who you'll hear at 4 o'clock this afternoon. And A. Martinez is in the air traveling. And Molly Knight joins us on the Triple Play, sports writer and author of the baseball newsletter The Long Game and author of The Best Team Money Can Buy, the L.A. Dodgers' Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse. Molly, let me start with you. The Dodgers, despite a bullpen game with a parade of non-starting pitchers, pitched great and broke out in the batter's box. Big win for them.
Yeah, it was an incredible victory. I really did not feel good about their chances heading into that game because they're facing Atlanta's ace, Max Fried. They've got a bullpen game, like you said. The Braves have looked so good this series. The Dodgers have been beat up. Obviously, Justin Turner injured his hamstring and is out for the season. That happened in Game 4. So it was a gutty, gutty win. And I don't think anybody encompasses that better than Chris Taylor. You know, he was a guy who was a Seattle Mariners afterthought. They got rid of him for a minor league pitcher named Zach Lee, who never panned out. And look at what Taylor's done. He won the NLCS MVP award in 2017. And gosh, if the Dodgers win this series, he's looking like the front runner to win that award again.
Which, with him heading into free agency, is great for him to see this kind of a club. He makes the All-Star game this year and then has this kind of great performance. Nick, your thoughts on last night's game? I guess I feel like even if the Dodgers lose the series, it kind of cleansed the palate a bit from the preceding debacle.
Yeah, well, it was a fabulous game, and so many things happened that I hadn't expected. So I'll just say out front, folks, really, I don't know very much about baseball at all. I've been talking about it for a long time, and because when you look at, who are the relief pitchers who held the Braves in check yesterday? It was a bunch of guys that, you know, Evan Phillips, who wasn't even on the team at the start of the season, came in and got the Dodgers out of a jam when Joe Kelly came out with an injury. And then, then they ran through, their second line of relievers, and they were fabulous. It was tremendous. And then, you know, Chris Taylor hits three home runs. I mean, who does that? You know, of all the guys on the Dodgers who would likely do that, you don't expect it's going to be Chris Taylor. And then A.J. Pollock breaks out of a slump and hits a couple of home runs, and the Dodgers look fabulous. And if you just take things sort of individually and say, would you take the Dodgers' chances, you know, Max Scherzer against the Braves in Atlanta and then Walker Buehler against the Braves in Atlanta? You'd say, yeah, sure, I'd take that for sure. So it, on one hand, it looks good. But on the other hand, this team has been sort of hot and cold. Like, they're either really great or really poor. And I don't know which team shows up on Saturday and Sunday.
Molly, you a little concerned that Scherzer, when he came out of his last start, indicated he was tired?
Yeah, definitely. And for him to admit that, I mean, he must have been beyond tired. Now, I don't know. This guy is a big game pitcher. He's one of the best pitchers in the world. If he falters tomorrow, it's not going to be because of some mental blip or nerves or being overwhelmed by the crowd or any of that. It's just going to be because his arm is beyond tired. Now, It's possible he's had what, 5-6 days off. So it's possible that he's going to come out there tomorrow and be the pitcher that the Dodgers traded for him to be. I mean, let's not forget, this is the guy who went out there. They won his first 12 starts that he pitched for them. And the one they lost, the only one they lost was, or I guess they lost against the Braves too, but the first one they lost against the Giants, he goes out there and they lose 1-0. He pitched brilliantly. So this is a guy they want out there. Like you said, I it's tough. Would I take the Braves being up 3-2, or would I take the Dodgers being down 3-2 with those two guys going? I think it's even, honestly.
Wow. Wow. So the Dodgers, of course, with what have been their two best pitchers going in these final two games, if there is a game seven. But if you would have said, Nick, that Max Muncy and Justin Turner, their terrific hitting corner infielders, Clayton Kershaw, now Joe Kelly, who's done for the year, were going to be out. Cody Bellinger would have a historically awful season, but is now starting to show signs of hitting again. I mean, you wouldn't have given this team much chance, would you?
No, not at all. The way that things were looking, but then all of a sudden you go into the postseason and everything changes. I mean, Bellinger fixed his swing and is looking like Cody Bellinger again. And Chris Taylor starts hitting like crazy, and a whole bunch of, you know, guys whose names, who weren't even on the team that won last year, start pitching great out of the bullpen. And all of a sudden, you're encouraged again. So when Molly wrote the book, you know, The Best Team Money Can Buy, I mean, that was right. They built a team that had, you know, exchangeable parts so that if one guy goes down, you have another guy come in and you would hope that he would play great. Now, it kind of hit some bumps when Jock Peterson and Kike Hernandez left last season, but there's still enough that you can kind of fix what's going on. Chris Taylor is a perfect example of that. He's at third base now, and the whole defense kind of orders up again. Cody Bellinger is back in center field, and Mookie Betts is now spending time in right field where he should be, and even the batting order is kind of back to what it should be. You know, Trey Turner was batting third. He wasn't hitting as batting third. Now he goes back to second. He's hitting again. So everything kind of goes back the way that it ought to be, and that is encouraging. To me, at least.
Molly, do you think that the Dodgers will in any way change their pitching strategy in these past two games? We've seen, you know, the starters in some cases get early hooks. We've seen use of starters as relievers. Or do you think there's sort of, analytics approach to how they use pitchers is going to continue?
Yeah, I think we're going to see more of the same. Honestly, it's a great question. I think to your point too, are they going to change anything? I think their lineup, they're going to run the same lineup out there in game six. I would be surprised if there were any changes, maybe Matt Beatty for Albert Pujols at first base. But I think, when things are going right, you don't want to mess with it. I think Scherzer knows and understands that even though he wants to pitch into the seventh, eighth inning, that if he's got any trouble at all, there's going to be a quick hook, for their bullpen. That's frankly been the best bullpen I've ever seen this team have.
It's great.
It's been a shame that this year they went to Julio Urias in game two to close out to pitch the eighth inning with the lead. And it was the series defining mistake, not only because Urias, you know, hindsight's 2020, he gives up a couple of runs there, but their bullpen has been so phenomenal. You think, gosh, you could have just trusted your pen there. Mm-hmm. But I think going forward, they're not going to have that problem. Like you said, yesterday was just incredible effort from those guys after Kelly got hurt.
It was an amazing performance by the bullpen and, of course, by the batters going nuts for the Dodgers. Again, game six, the time is to be determined, dependent on what happens in tonight's American League game six between the Red Sox and the Astros. It'll either be at 2:00 or at 5:00 tomorrow on TBS. And then we'll hope there's a game seven on Sunday. Thanks so much, Molly Knight and Nick Roman, joining us, the Triple Play on Air Talk. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. I'm joined by critics Amy Nicholson, who writes on film for the New York Times, and hosts the podcasts Unspooled and Zoom. Chrissy Lemire is film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the Breakfast All Day podcast. We begin this week with director and writer Denis Villeneuve's Dune, this adaptation of the extremely popular Frank Herbert novel of 1965. The film stars Timothy Chalamet, Rebecca Ferguson, Oscar Isaac, and Josh Brolin, also Stellan Skarsgård in the cast. Christy, what did you think of Dune?
I was blown away by this movie, and I wasn't particularly looking forward to seeing it. It is 2.5 hours, and I'm like, oh, it's going to be a slog. But it is such an incredible technical achievement that I was completely blown away by it over and over again. If you have read the book, if you've seen the David Lynch 1984 version of Dune, this is the same exact story. You know, as the year is 10,191 and the spice melange is the most powerful substance in the galaxy and it fuels planets and it serves as currency and its power. And Timothy Chalamet is the son of the head of the House of Atreides. They have to go to the planet Arrakis to go and oversee the spice production, but it's probably a trap and it's all palace intrigue between different rival houses vying for power. But then there are people who live on this planet too, trying to survive in the middle of it. Denis Villeneuve makes incredibly accomplished technical feats. I mean, this is every single frame of this is stunningly beautiful. And it feels like a really weighty and substantial film. You watch, you know, big Marvel epics and they're all CGI. They look very glossy. This feels substantial. This feels like a real film. And the sound design's incredible. The Hans Zimmer score is incredible. The costume design, Greg Fraser's cinematography, good Lord. If you can go see this in IMAX like I did, I'm so glad I saw it in IMAX. If you have been thinking about going back to the movies, if you've needed an event to spur you to get there, this should be the one. It's just totally immersive. Having said that, I felt nothing emotionally. Denis Villeneuve makes beautiful films that are very emotionally detached, none more so than this one. That was true of Arrival and his Blade Runner. That is very true here. Everyone's good in it. Timothy Chalamet as your messiah figure. He's perfectly cast. So I felt nothing, but I was dazzled.
Dune, Amy.
Yeah, everything about Denis Villeneuve that keeps me from loving his previous works really works here. You know, I mean, like Dune is like, I mean, it's been considered like an unfilmable story. You know, it's a story where the locations are big and expensive and wild, but the drama is very interior. You're living in this mindset that you do not understand. All of these moral codes of like duty and sacrifice that even the good guys abide by, like, are incredibly harsh and unsympathetic. But Denis's, I would say, like, chilly, inhuman quality works really perfectly here, because from the beginning, you really get into the mindset of these characters on the planet Arrakis. This is a movie that I think doesn't ask for your sympathy, like, it's, or empathy. It doesn't ask you to even like these characters very much. It has two jokes in the entire movie, and neither one of them really work that well. They both pop out and they waste both of them in the trailer anyway. But this is really a film that kind of demands awe and respect from the audience. It demands that you give in to being immersed. And if you resist being immersed in this film, which I totally get, I've been there with like his own Blade Runner movie, this film is going to feel like a slog. But if you just grok out to this gigantic movie, you know, you start to appreciate how, like, yes, this is like such a foundational text for like Star Wars and everything to come. And yes, this is a movie that has, you know, four characters from like our other, you know, Marvel space operas. It's got Bautista, Momoa, Skarsgård, Brolin, but they're not trying to make the world so simple and complex. They're not trying to have heroes save the day. I mean, if you've read the books, and I have read the books in college, you know, you realize that like Denis's after something closer to like Lawrence of Arabia, you know, about how like it's not just being born to power that counts. It's about how power misleads you and it corrupts you. To really get to all those ideas, we have to have a sequel. And I hope that we do. I really do, you know. And also, one of the things I was looking out for is, you know, are they going to make an allusion to one of the things in here that always stuck in my brain from the books, that like these special super suits they have to wear to stay alive on the planet Arrakis, you know, they pee in them. They're kind of like full body diapers, and they use their urine to like recycle the water to keep them hydrated. I mean, they touch on it. And I was grateful for that, because it's a weird, dense book, and to even try to grapple with it takes a person with ambition. And well, Denny definitely has that.
We're talking about Dune, directed and co-written by Denis Villeneuve. The film's rated PG-13. It's on big screens, including IMAX format in wide release, and streaming on HBO Max. Dune, rated PG-13. Now, our John Horn talked with director Denis Villeneuve, and if you're listening to Film Week on Friday, we don't have that conversation for you broadcast, but you can hear the entire Film Week, including John's interview, by picking up the podcast at kpcc.org or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're listening to Saturday Film Week, that conversation is coming right up on the air with John Horn. Our second film this week is the comedic drama The French Dispatch. The film stars Benicio del Toro, Adrian Brody, Tilda Swinton, and Lea Seydoux. The film's written and directed by Wes Anderson, and Timothée Chalamet, who was starring in Dune, is also in The French Dispatch, as is Frances McDormand. What a cast, Amy.
Yeah, and I think Wes Anderson actually has a lot in common with Denis Villeneuve in that he's a director that people find heavily stylized and that I've had to wrestle with to really get onto his wavelength. But the thing with Wes Anderson is, and I feel out of step with this with most people and their feelings for Wes Anderson, the less normal his stories have gotten, the less he feels like compelled to tell stories about, like, you know, why is my family screwed up? Why am I sad? Can I ever be happy? The more I actually really like his style and how it works. And so I feel like I'm going to be standing alone and really defending The French Dispatch, which is about as stylized as he's gotten. This is a story of the last issue of a magazine that's called The French Dispatch, which is basically his version of The New Yorker. And the movie itself is structured like you're paging through the magazine. It's a series of long-form articles done as short films narrated by their writers. So you have Tilda Swinton as the art critic, Frances McDormand as this political correspondent, Jeffrey Wright is the food writer, Owen Wilson is kind of the gutter trash obsessed local color writer who's based on Joseph Mitchell, who's one of my personal favorite writers of all time at The New Yorker. He wrote about like fishermen and bridge builders and bearded ladies during the Depression. And then you have Bill Murray, who's the editor of the magazine. He's like the protector of their stories. And he is probably the last standing guy in journalism who would rather cut advertisements than trim on a piece that's coming in three times too long. And at the start of the film, we're told that he has died and that this magazine, this last issue, will die with him. And what I really see here in this movie, and especially when you lay it next to something about like Grand Budapest Hotel, is that Wes Anderson himself really sees himself as this protector of beautiful stories and interesting people, and who will tell the kind of stories he's interested in if he isn't there to make them, if he isn't defending the right to make these kind of music box curio animated films that, you know, are done to be sort of designy and fanciful and beautiful and magical. And I like this lane for him. I really do. I think people will find this slight and charming maybe, but I feel like it'll deepen more when I watch it again. I think it's just marvelous minute to minute. I mean, there's even like a gag of having a big chase sequence animated in the style of a New Yorker magazine cover. So it's really for New Yorker heads.
The French Dispatch from Wes Anderson. Christy.
I ordinarily really love Wes Anderson, but I love Wes Anderson for the opposite reasons that Amy does. And I love when he actually takes the time to find the reasons and explore his character's sadness. So some of my favorites are like Rushmore and Moonrise Kingdom and Fantastic Mr. Fox. And this is like the most Wes Anderson-y Wes Anderson movie ever in terms of just its excess of style. It is all of his self-indulgences writ large in tiny font. And if that is your cup of tea, you're gonna love this. I find those tendencies in his filmmaking to be increasingly repetitive and just a little boring, actually. Like the fact that he'll come up with, you know, the tiny little maps and the tiny little dollhouses and everything is like perfect and small. I know he obsesses over that stuff, and I admire the dedication to craft and to, you know, his lane, as Amy put it so well. But it's so crammed and it's such a giant cast that you see people like Edward Norton's in it for like 2 seconds. You know, and it's like, oh, right, he's here. Oh, right, Bill Murray's here. People who are his frequent players.
Yeah.
When there are actors given a chance to really develop a part, like Tilda Swinton is hilarious in this. Adrian Brody, hilarious in this. They get some room to play. Otherwise, I found it just, dreadful.
The French Dispatch rated R in select theaters. It's Film Week on KPCC.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.
It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us, joined by critics Christy Lemire and Amy Nicholson. Our next film is the drama Passing. It's based on a novel by Nella Larsen. It's the story of two African-American women who can pass as white but choose to live on opposite sides of the color line in 1929 New York. Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga star in the film, which is written and directed by Rebecca Hall, making both her feature directing and writing debut. Christy, please tell us about Passing.
Oh, it's such a beautiful film. It's just achingly sad and just delicate and gorgeous. It's in this very high contrast black and white, and it's in Academy ratio, so it's boxy, which kind of gives a sense of intimacy, but also claustrophobia as you follow along with the characters and the choices that they make and the increasing tension that they find themselves in. So as you mentioned, Tessa Thompson, Ruth Negga play childhood friends who reunite in the late 20s in New York. They are both of mixed race and grew up together in Harlem. Nella Larsen herself was of mixed race. And it's about how the Ruth Negga character, Claire, is passing as a white woman. And not only that, she's married to a white man, played by Alexander Skarsgård, playing yet another terrible husband. He always does that. And if you ever saw Big Little Lies. And he not only is white, but he hates black people. He's a total racist. And so when Claire and Tessa Thompson's Irene or Renee, when they reconnect, and the husband doesn't realize that she also is black, he says horrific things in front of her. And it's about how the two friends kind of fall into this mutual fascination with one another's lives. And Andre Holland is great also as Tessa Thompson's husband. And there's such chemistry. It's like, it's sexy and it's playful and it's tense between these two women and the choices that they've made. The costume design is just exquisite, all the production design, and it's paced in a way that the tension really steadily builds. It's an incredible debut from Rebecca Hall. I can see why she was drawn to this story. It's these really rich performances from these two tremendous actresses. If I say I enjoyed it, I'm not sure I enjoyed it, but I was really moved by it and really impressed by it.
Passing is the film. Amy?
Yeah, Passing is terrific. I mean, this is a movie where when Tessa Thompson first meets Ruth Negga for the first time since childhood, she sees that, you know, Ruth with her blonde hair, with her white husband, seems so kind of sparkling and comfortable in the white world that you first meet her in. You know, she's just on the phone ordering up drinks from room service in code because the prohibition's still on. But then Ruth goes to visit Tessa in Harlem, where Tessa is sort of a grand dame of her neighborhood. You know, she's married to a doctor. She throws the charity balls. And you realize that, like, she's now that, like, Ruth is uncomfortable in this world. And so it's a story where, like, their positions are just continually being reversed. Who's more comfortable here? Who's making themselves more comfortable here? It's a story about always wondering if somebody's life is a little bit better. And Ruth is the kind of the character who will go after the things she wants to try to make her life better. And so it's also a story about the ways people can feel kind of exiled from their community or pushed out or kicked out of, like, their family, their friend group, which is a really relatable feeling, you know, especially when you tell stories about, like, female friendship, about feeling like an outcast, about feeling like somebody's trying to take your place. The cinematography here is terrific. Like, it really captures this feeling of being watched and watching. There's a lot of, like, over the shoulder looks, feeling that people are staring at you. They do a lot of work at the cinematography about sort of, like, lightening and darkening the shades of the women, lightening and darkening the houses so they stand out more here, don't stand out here. And I also want to say that, like, Rebecca Hall did a great job with just the screenplay as well. You know, like, the original book was pretty short, so she's done a lot of work kind of expanding and deepening it while making it feel really legitimate. Like, nothing in passing feels like we're layering modern ideas onto an old story. She's made a film that feels really legitimately of its era, where the women feel true to their mindset and the mentality of the day, of their way of being, of what they notice. And so just across the board, this is a really standout debut.
Passing is the film. The drama's rated PG-13, starring Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga. Rebecca Hall wrote and directed it. It starts next Wednesday in select theaters and then will be streaming on Netflix starting November 10th. Passing, the film. The Harder They Fall is a Western that's in wide release and also starts streaming on Netflix November 3rd. The cast, including Jonathan Majors, Idris Elba, Zazie Bates, Regina King, Delroy Lindo, Lakeith Stanfield, James Samuel directed and co-wrote The Harder They Fall. Amy.
This is a giant Western that is so, so, so fun. You might notice from the title that it's nodding to the 1972 Jimmy Cliff movie, The Harder They Come. You know, this Jamaican crime movie that's kind of famous here for being the movie that with a soundtrack that brought reggae to the United States. In that movie, they actually watched the original Django film. And so this is kind of spinning off that. It's like if that movie it's more Tarantino than John Ford as a Western, is what I'll say about that. It's the kind of movie that opens with that kind of bold, merciless, people dying, opening credits are screaming out nicknames like Lakeith Stanfield as Cherokee Bill. And then you get into the story, which is that you have these two rival gangs. One is headed by Jonathan Majors, who's just one of our absolute best young actors today. The other one is headed by Idris Elba, and Idris Elba's just gotten out of jail to reclaim the throne of his gang. And of course, they're going to go head to head in these ways that's, you know, sometimes based on vengeance, a lot of time based on loyalty. There's hotheads on both sides. There's soulful people on both sides, especially Lakeith Stanfield, who's kind of this, like, really soulful but underwritten secondary villain on the Idris Elba gang. They're just having fun in this film. It's really like a bold version of a Western where, you know, sometimes you'll go into a bar and there'll be a dancer who's all painted blue. Sometimes there'll be a knife fight in a brightly colored fabric factory. In one scene, they go to a white town to rob a white bank, and the entire town is just white, like the buildings and the sand, the ads for Ivory soap.
That's funny.
There's a huge body count here. Super fun roles for, like, Regina King, Zazie Beetz, and a newer actress to me, Danielle Deadwyler. I think it's rare to see a Western with this many actors that you like on both sides, which kind of makes it more painful when the bloodbath starts. You like everybody, even the bad guys. Everybody's a little bit bad, and you just want to have everybody drink a beer so you can hang out more in this movie.
The Harder They Fall. Christy.
I dug this too. It's just a big, ambitious swing. It's so much fun. Visually, it's steeped in, you know, Western B movies, but the language is totally modern. And the music, as Amy mentioned, is a reggae feel to a lot of the music. And that anachronistic mix of stuff just works. And this cast is gorgeous and charismatic. And they're all up for the challenges of the physicality of the Western, but also the almost like blaxploitation brutality of it. Lakeith is so sexy in this and so funny. And everyone here gets just such rich, meaty work to play with. Tarantino wishes he made this movie because it pulls off that balance, that genre mashup so well. And he tends to go overboard, and that's his thing. That's his vibe. But this is just like a perfect balance. James Samuel, who directed this, also has worked with Jay-Z quite a bit. And so a lot of the music in it is very cool. He's a singer-songwriter as well. And it's just a lot of fun. It's a little long. It's like 2 hours and 20 minutes long. And there's a big, long fight scene with some parallel editing between a couple of different rival gang folks that might go on a bit too long. Maybe didn't need to, but it's always just spectacular to look at and has great energy.
The Harder They Fall is rated R. It's in wide release right now, and then it'll be streaming on Netflix starting in about a week and a half. The animated adventure Ron's Gone Wrong is directed by Sarah Smith, Jean-Philippe Vine, and Octavio Rodriguez. Christy.
This is an animated adventure, which may seem very familiar in a lot of ways. It's about this misfit middle schooler named Barney, and he is lonely and isolated, and he, you know, totally avoids having to deal with recess because it means he has no friends to play with. But this giant tech behemoth, kind of like Apple, they're called Bubble. They come out with these adorable little sidekick droid pals called Bebots, and they follow along with you, and they know everything that you like, and they're hooked into all your apps, and they help you connect with other people. And the very idealistic hoodie wearing inventor who created this wanted it to be legitimately about friendship, but the CEO, the evil profit-obsessed CEO, is all about, you know, pleasing the shareholders. Barney gets a misfit, sort of mixed up version of one of these droids, voiced by Zach Galifianakis, and madcap hilarity ensues. And it's sort of like Big Hero 6 in that he's adorable and perky and well-intentioned, but he has these awkward turns of phrase and he's extremely literal. And the process of watching them bounce off of each other and become friends and learn from each other is a lot of fun. I laugh quite a bit. I brought my son, Nick, who's almost 12, so he could relate to a lot of this. He laughed quite a bit, but it's trying to have its cake and eat it too, because it's trying to be this indictment of the evils of big tech and just the insidious, invasive nature of technology and of social media and the way that, you know, bullying, you know, online can change your whole day. But it's also about the power of technology to help you connect with other people and learn about anything you want and the touch of a few keystrokes. And so it's trying to kind of have it both ways if you really think about the messaging here. But if you want to have a good time, it's colorful, it's lively. I laughed quite a bit. It's very cute.
The animated film Ron's Gone Wrong, it's rated PG and it's in wide release. Coming up on Film Week, we'll hear what Amy and Christy have to say about the sci-fi thriller Warning and the electrical life of Louis Wayne. That's all coming up on Film Week. Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Amy Nicholson and Christy Lemire. Next up, the sci-fi thriller Warning, which stars Alice Eve, Alex Pettifer, and Thomas Jane. Agatha Alexander is the director and co-screenwriter. Amy, please tell us about Warning.
I'm really happy to. This is another interesting debut. It's a collection of these intercut, morbid sci-fi shorts that are set 7 years into the future. You know it's 7 years into the future because there's like a passing reference to COVID-28, which if you chuckle darkly at that, that's kind of the tone of this series. Basically, what these stories are about is they're all about how technology has untethered people from their humanity. You know, the warning of the title is more directed at us than the characters. The most literally untethered person is there's this satellite maintenance worker played by Thomas Jane, who's out in outer space and he's been accidentally cut loose and he's just drifting above us futilely while the voice in his ear is telling him very clearly that he's not valuable enough to bother rescuing. So he should just accept floating out here for the next 6 days until that's it for him. Also on Earth, you have people like this self-improvement nut who's played by Alice Eve. And she's really codependent on this Alexa type thing called a god that like tries to make her a better person. It counts her swearing. It makes sure she's eating right vegetables. There's a guy who works at a shelter for lost androids and has to wrestle with the idea of euthanizing robots that nobody wants because they tell really bad jokes. There's couples who are in terrible angst. One of them is because like his parents don't want him to date a girl who doesn't have the more money to be immortal. There's a really dark segment that stars the girl from Raw, Garance Meillier, where she's a teenager who rents her body, not in a sex worker way, but more like so people can wear her teenage body and walk around in. Anyway, this is what's happening in this film. None of these characters interconnect at all. It's really just a story that's like depressing and anxious, and I found really bleakly funny. But you have to have a real cynical sense of humor to chuckle at some of the dark jokes in here. I mean, it's the obvious parallel is something like Black Mirror, but this is not a thing that has kind of that O. Henry jocular haha gotcha spirit of a Black Mirror. It's more just a little bit sloppy in a way that feels like human and beautiful and sad, more like giving a speech at a funeral for mankind than anything else, a speech with a few black jokes.
Warning is rated R. It's available on multiple on-demand platforms. The biographical drama The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne stars Benedict Cumberbatch and Claire Foy. Will Sharp is the director and co-screenwriter with Simon Stevenson. Christy.
This is a biopic of the English artist Louis Wayne, who was known for these incredibly colorful and whimsical and anthropomorphized drawings and paintings of cats. I was thinking about Amy the whole time I was watching this because she's a crazy cat lady herself. I knew she would love it. It's all about the mystical healing power of cats. Benedict Cumberbatch plays Louis Wayne over several years of his life. And it's this extremely showy role for him. It allows him to show so much of what he does so well because in the beginning, he's kind of awkward and kind of fidgety, clearly brilliant, but misunderstood. And he falls for Claire Foy, who similarly is a little socially awkward. She is the governess for his family. And the scenes with the two of them together are really lovely. As they find peace with each other, as they find comfort with each other in a way that they never have in any other setting, the two of them are quite lovely, and she is the inspiration behind his love for cats. As time goes on, his mental illness reveals itself, and so we're following him over the course of many decades, and so Benedict Cumberbatch must play a lot of different versions of this character over time as his mental state evolves, and it's a pretty traditional biopic in a lot of ways, except for some tonal quirks and some really beautiful cinematography. Eric Wilson is a cinematographer. He also shot the Paddington movies. And so it's quite beautiful and painterly in this like ethereal, surreal way as it reflects his inner mental state. Everyone's very good in it. Andrea Riseborough is very good in it as his sister. But structurally, it's a pretty traditional biopic.
All right, Amy, what do you think of The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne?
Well, the number one problem with this film is that there are not enough cats. I was very much promised cats. And you don't really get a whole lot of cats until the ending, where over the end credits, you see his paintings. And his paintings of cats, I felt like, had more energy and wit than almost anything else in this film. I mean, Louis Wayne is a really interesting character, but you know, there's this speculation about his art now that he has passed on. Since he did suffer from a mental illness, a lot of things that weren't diagnosed properly, or nobody knew really what to call how he was at the time. People today have like read into his things, you know, that as his art gets more and more crazy and futurist, as the lines get wilder and jaggeder, as the sense of where the cat is in the picture is harder and harder to sense out, that his paintings have even been put in like psychology textbooks as like, you are watching an artist lose control of who they are. And now, of course, people are re-questioning that theory about him and saying he just liked making crazy cats. These cats look insane because he was a true artist. And that's the debate I kind of wanted to be in this film, but there's really not that much in here actually about his art. You know, it's more about the sentiment of his life, about feeling sorry for him, and less about him as a creator. I wish there was more art. I wish there were a lot more cats. The cats didn't really start to emerge into the film for like an hour. And even then, you just see them like in slow motion, licking themselves in the rain. There is a story here that I guess I wanted more of like, how did we become obsessed with cats? Because when he starts painting them, it is weird to have a cat for a pet. And there is an argument that Louis Wayne is why I might be obsessed with cats today. But that's not really in the film. It's just kind of nodded to as you watch Benedict Cumberbatch cry and scream and, you know, be variously giantly sad.
The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne, starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Claire Foy, Will Sharp directed and co-wrote, rated PG-13 in select theaters, and in a couple of weeks it'll be available on Amazon Prime Video. Christy, I'm of that age where I grew up eagerly anticipating Jacques Cousteau television documentaries about undersea life and Cousteau's work. This week we have a documentary in wide release from director Liz Garbus, Becoming Cousteau. How is it?
It's pretty good, especially if you are a fan of those old TV shows. I'm sure you'll really appreciate this, especially it's got a lot of newly restored archive footage of him and his earliest days of becoming, you know, obsessed with the sea and how he evolved as a cultural figure over the decades from being, you know, an explorer to a filmmaker, which he truly felt was his calling. He felt like he wasn't happy unless he was making movies about ocean life, to becoming a really active environmentalist, you know, using his platform for conservation. And then sadly, toward the end of his life, feeling kind of frustrated by that, by people's unwillingness to accept that, you know, the planet was changing. And so he was sort of a maverick in that regard. It's a very traditional documentary in a lot of ways, but if you are fascinated by this man and his life, you hear him in interviews being quite candid about what a bad father he was, what an absent father and husband he was, because he was away, you know, his life, his love, and his lady was the sea, as the song goes. And so he was gone a lot. But if you already are interested in him, for sure, you'll enjoy this.
All right. Becoming Cousteau, rated PG-13, Liz Garbus, the director, and the documentary's in wide release. And for recommendations on spooky streaming things, Christy recommends Lego Star Wars Terrifying Tales. It's streaming on Disney+. Amy recommends Ghoul Log. Shudder's going to have its version of the Yule Log that we've been used to seeing with the burning log at Christmas. This instead, an ever-burning jack-o'-lantern on Shudder. Also recommending Boys in the Trees on YouTube, Google, and iTunes. It's Film Week on KPCC.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiots and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.